Welcome back to the Media Movie Club podcast. I'm John Kissel, and with me tonight is Shane Settner.
Yo!
Pierce Bauer.
What's up?
And J.R. Peters.
Howdy, howdy.
We are gathered here tonight at the start of a new year to discuss some of our cultural favorites, mostly movies, but not only movies, from the previous year, 2020. We're going to do what we usually do. We're just going to go around the horn and select one of whatever really tickled our fancies in this last year. Just go one at a time. I'm going to go and then so on and so on and so on until we're out of stuff. I'm going to start with my favorite movie of the year, unless something really blows my mind in the next week or so before I make my list. Possessor. This is a movie by the son of David Cronenberg, Brandon Cronenberg. It's his first movie since Antiviral. Long-time listeners of the Media Movie Club podcast might remember back in, I want to say, March or April when we did a coronavirus quarantine podcast. One of the categories was Immersion and Antiviral, which was a movie about like transmitting famous people's diseases amongst their diehard fans as like a form of like fan worship.
that was like right when we thought we could watch. We're just gonna watch a couple of these things. We're gonna three week pandemic.
You could still be doing your immersion therapy at this point. It would have made no difference. But Brandon Cronenberg directed that movie, and his long awaited follow up is Possessor, another movie that is extremely well suited to this time. It is about a assassination squad, like a corporate espionage group, whose preferred method is to infiltrate the mind of a random person, someone who's close to the target, and send one of their assassins into that mind and then have them act as that person as they're assassinated. The main target is a tech titan played by Sean Bean. His company is doing some kind of, it's what you suspect is happening with your Alexas and your Google helpers or whatever they're called. They're just mapping out people's houses, probably to recreate some kind of virtual reality. I don't know. It's very dystopian.
I thought Alexa and everything were just copying everything I say to blackmail me later.
Well, what if they were also like marking every piece of furniture in your house and product?
I'd rather them do that than discuss the things I say when I'm by myself.
Why not both? Maybe it's doing both.
Sir, why were you talking about hentai porn to your dog?
Why weren't you, Amazon?
How were they mapping what furniture you have?
It's not clear. I'm just kind of off on a tangent at this point.
I think the Roomba is doing that.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the Roomba does map your house. It's just an invasion of privacy product to match with the invasion of like mental space that is the assassination plot. It stars Andrea Riseborough. She was in Mandy. Yeah, she's just in a lot of very strange indie movies, and this is another one. It's extremely violent. It's extremely violent because there's a level of detachment between the person who's actually doing the violence and the target of their violence, in the same way that like if you're anonymous online, you're just a little meaner to a person as opposed to like if you knew their real name. Mm-hmm. It's incredibly smart. It's practically unrecommendable because of the level of violence in it. But it is directly in my wheelhouse as far as weird cinema, as far as just every like frame and every scene has some kind of like metaphorical, allegorical relevance to real life. This is one of the few movies that I was able to see in theaters this year. But I sat in the Plaza with just a huge grin on my face compared to what was happening on the screen. It would have marked me as a psychopath if someone was able to see my reaction to it. This is a great movie. I don't think it's out on streaming yet. It might be out for VOD. But if you have the stomach for this kind of thing, and it is, again, extremely violent, extremely psychedelic, extremely like nightmare imagery, I could not recommend it more.
It's only $1.99 to rent on Amazon right now.
Hey, $2 and go on a crazy psychic torture ride.
Anytime I can watch family members murder their family members or friends murder friends that they don't know that they're friends, but they're not friends, I gotta watch that.
Yeah.
I'm always saying that exact paragraph.
It's pretty twisty. It's pretty twisty. Pierce, how about one of your best of 2020s?
Yeah, I'll go with something not quite as twisted as whatever you're into, John. But something that I actually think is one of the best things I've seen this year. It's not exactly a TV show, but it's also not exactly one movie. It is the anthology series Small Axe from director Steve McQueen on Amazon Prime. And basically what he did is he did like five anthology films all within like anywhere between 1 hour to 2 hours. Each one dealing with like a different story about West Indian immigrant experiences in London between like the 60s and the 80s. And but particularly the things, the two that I think stand out are the first two like episodes, Mangrove and Lover's Rock. Mangrove is about a restaurant in London in the 70s called the Mangrove Restaurant, which was like a meeting place for Black activists in London at the time. Like that location kept being raided by police and, you know, patrons of it kept being brutalized and harassed, all those things. And essentially it evokes this protest that turns into something we saw in 2020, you know, very, very similarly. With Black Lives Matter protests. And then it becomes like a court drama about these protesters on trial for their involvement in what they, you know, the courts deemed a riot. It is this very like honest and caring portrayal of these people in this time period, and actually is interested in portraying their real lives and the effects that this trauma has on who they are as individuals and as a group. Everything that was happening in this time period that Steve McQueen seems very tied to is like something new to me, but also like something that very much connects to 2020. So I thought that as a film is, it's like 2 hours long and it goes through this court case and it is just very captivating, and it doesn't fall into the tropes of like a good comparison point would be the trial of the Chicago Seven that also came out this year, which is like super sensationalized and kind of fictionalized to fit the narrative that those filmmakers or that filmmaker wanted to tell, versus Mangrove is like a very real depiction of like actual abuse and actual trauma. And it actually like is interested in the humanity within its characters and their culture and how these events actually affected them. And then to pair with that, Lover's Rock, which is really, I think, the standout. Again, it doesn't really follow like traditional like movie like guidelines. Like it's only an hour or maybe a little over an hour. You don't really have characters with names. And it's just this very interesting, like follows this house party in London in the 80s that is attended by this community of like teenagers of immigrant descent in London. And for the entire, whatever it is, like 80 minutes, there's a constant soundtrack playing in the background. The camera just floats around this dance floor and through this house where like you have women cooking and serving food to all the like, you know, residents of this party. You have people just like dancing together, singing together. And it is this like beautiful kind of microcosm of like a culture just in like their space within the city that they are only allotted this one space at this one time, and they make the most of it. And it's this really incredible expression of, you know, identity and like music and dancing and all of these things that make these people who they are. And it's just incredible filmmaking. I recommend the whole series, like all five of the movies are great, but those two in particular are just like really, especially as a pair of like, one is this portrait of abuse and trauma. And then Lover's Rock is kind of this like release of freedom and expression. And it really just makes you like wish you could go to a house party and just like dance with your friends and like sing at the top of your lungs. JR, I know you said you really liked this one too.
I mean, there's nothing more to say. I mean, you basically said it all. It's one of those movies that does a very good job of putting you in the middle of it. And so, you know, there are tons of movies that get made where you feel like you're watching a movie versus in this movie, you feel like you're actually part of the party and witnessing everything in the room. It does a very good job of creating that space for you to be in. And then the only other thing I want to say, I was going to say on top of that is the Lover's Rock. It's named Lover's Rock because it's a style of reggae that they are playing through. It's the soundtrack that they do throughout the whole, 70 minutes or however long it is, hour and 10 minutes. It's a style of romantic sounding reggae, and it's what's used throughout the whole thing. So it's like just showing you a party that is fueled by Lover's Rock.
Yeah, the soundtrack is like a genre I was not super familiar with, but the movie does an incredible job of like making you fall in love with that and just like, you know, wanting to be a part of it. So yeah.
I haven't seen any of those five movies. I don't feel like I could make a credible for who cares? No one's watching, no one's listening. But in my mind, I can't make a credible top 10 or 20 of the year without seeing at least one. I'm going to try and get Mangrove done in the next week or so. But you guys are really selling Lover's Rock. Like Pierce, you mentioned like the food prep or cooking and all that, and like that was one of the standout sequences in Moonlight, which, you know, isn't Steve McQueen, but anytime you can have a good cooking sequence, I'm into your movie. Like even Jon Favreau's Chef, a movie I otherwise can't stand.
God,
cooking sequences in that movie were pretty good.
Yeah,
and Lover's Rock has the added benefit of being 70 minutes. This is the best of 2020, not the worst of the decade. So we can't talk about Chef. JR, what are one of your best of 2020?
So Tiger King, or as I like to call it, white people, white peopling.
Sure.
There's no other way to describe it but amazing. It is a documentary, quote unquote, series on a group of multiple groups of people that do big cat rescuing, and it focuses on one specific big cat rescue where the guy leading its name, I don't even know what his name is, Joe Exotic, I think, calls himself the Tiger. And just the wild way he went about doing this tiger rescue, all the illegal stuff he did, the horrible the horrible treatment of the people around him and the other rescue people, how they all felt about each other, and he had a specific beef with one lady. It's a great look into the other. Everybody.
This is very strange. Backwoods subculture and wherever it is.
Yes.
Alabama?
Listening to... No, there. I think Tiger King, that dude, I don't think he was in Alabama. He was in like Arkansas or something like that.
Okay.
Well, I mean, not Arkansas. Yeah. But like, you know, everybody talking on this or listening to this most likely is related to us, so they're probably not extreme backwoods. So like, it's just a look into a whole different lifestyle. Where these guys are just living some kind of life that I am not familiar with at all. And it is
just raising some big old cats.
Yeah, raising big old cats, picking people up off the street that at one point they interview someone that worked with Tiger King, and they were talking about all these people he kept getting to work with them. And they said Tiger King specifically, Joe Exotic specifically had a person that would look at the train depot that stopped in the city, and if he ever saw anyone that looked like they didn't have any money, or they had ran away from home, or they were broke, they had nowhere else to go, they looked like they were addicted to drugs, or they knew they were addicted to drugs, Tiger King would go pick them up and give them a job. And so those are the types of people that are working with this narcissistic, wild dude. And I mean, it's just a wild look into the lives of some. And
I never watched this. I did see a lot of like comparisons, like on Twitter or in the various, like when it made the rounds on all the culture podcasts to listen to, about people comparing it to like Trump and Hillary, like their dynamic between Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin. That was her name. I don't know. And like Joe Exotic apparently is up for a pardon tomorrow. We're recording this the day before inauguration.
Yes. I hope he gets his pardon too. I don't think
he's like an attempted murderer, isn't he? and like an outright exploiter of desperate people and an abuser of beautiful animals.
Oh yeah. He
has all those things, but I would like to see
him. I want to see him pardoned because Trump's already got that fuck it in his system, so I just want to see him go like full fuck it and just pardon Joe Exotic.
All right.
It's just crazy that you're like seeing this stuff, you know? You know, we go about our day-to-day lives like getting up, going to work, playing with your kids, Shane, and then watching TV or whatever. And then going back to sleep, and this dude's out here putting hits out on people because he doesn't like the way this lady's treating her freaking mountain lion, like her captive mountain lion. You're like, this is just a whole different world, and it's great to see in that and to see that there's no black people in that world. It's amazing.
Shane, are there any black people in your first item?
All right, we'll talk about Cobra Kai. I had never watched the original series that was on YouTube TV. So we binged Cobra Kai, I think, with like half of all Netflix users. I think it was like one of the...
It is all on Netflix.
It's all on Netflix, okay. Yeah. So they dropped those first two seasons, like popped at the top. And so everyone watched it. It's a pandemic. And it was delightful. It's not a good show. It's better than any... It's like any... Like, it's good. I mean, it's not like... It's not great. I'm not... It's... You'll live if you don't watch it, but...
Like, if you came home after school in, say, the 90s, and there was, like, a live-action Saved by the Bell type stuff on TV, is it in that, like, real soapy, earnest, corny range?
No, I don't think it's that bad.
That's kind of what I expect from it.
It's
not that bad.
It's got some of the high school teen drama stuff.
Could this have aired in the TGIF block?
No.
Okay.
It could, there's too much violence directed towards children.
Damn it.
Which is actually,
I mean, when's the last time you saw Step by Step?
So it's like, I mean, anytime a grown man just pops back and hits a 16-year-old, unclear.
I'm in. That was my favorite part of Under the Silver Lake. So yeah, okay, I'll give it a shot.
It's, I mean, it's goofy. It's you're not gonna like the nostalgia, but it also kind of makes fun of the fact that it's nostalgic. It makes fun of the fact that there are karate gangs running around. It's. Fairly, they don't explain it. They just make fun of it briefly, and then it's like, okay, we all know this is dumb, but let's go with it. Does anyone else watch it?
Yes, I've seen it all, and I, like, the day season 3 dropped, so I binged the first two seasons probably 2 months ago, you know, 2 months ago or whatever, 3 months ago, and then I was, like, waiting for season 3 because it is a great watch. Like,
yes.
It you're not watching this. At no point are you, like, anybody in this is going to get nominated for anything. The acting, some of the acting's all right. Most of the acting, you're just like, this is corny, and I like
it. Yeah. Like, and I mean, and then they throw in like these superb fight scenes twice a season. And there's like that's it
twice a season.
Well, like these giant fight scenes where they giant do like a single shot. Like it's really well done, especially because most of these kids are actors, not just stunt doubles, or you can't stunt double all of it. Although I will say if they would have realized when they're first writing the show that the daughter would be doing so much karate, they probably would have cast a different person who could actually do something athletic.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah.
She's like one of the better actresses, but she
can't. Yeah. No.
She's not great around anything else. You can tell she's getting better as the show goes on, but it's still like compared to the other people. I mean, it's nothing, but I love this. I'm glad you put it on there. It is a total just like, I tell anyone, like, if you liked Karate Kid, even a little bit, you should just watch Cobra Kai because it's same ridiculousness, like, but as a series, and it's just a great fun watch.
My next pick is Sound of Metal, also on Amazon Prime. This is a movie starring Riz Ahmed from The Night Of and Rogue One, that's it, among other things. And he plays a heavy metal drummer who lives out of an RV with his girlfriend. They've got their gigs. Their life is simple and spare and kind of on like a razor's edge, but they love each other and it's okay. And then his hearing just goes. And the movie is extremely in his head, to the point where you basically hear what he doesn't hear, or you hear his hearing fading and then going, and then you hear how he adjusts with that over the course of the movie. It's a real psychological profile of this guy. It's a real interesting look into deaf culture. I remember watching ER in the late 90s when Dr. Benton, whoever Eric LaSalle played, I think his name was Dr. Benton. His kid lost his hearing or was born deaf, and there was a whole thing about how there's a lot of disagreement within the deaf community about whether or not to get cochlear implants. It's kind of like deaf people have created a language, and getting cochlear implants is seen as like shitting on that culture. It would be it's like the equivalent of pulling a Michael Jackson. And like that dilemma, that conflict is really explored in Sound of Metal, and it also just contains like a year best performance from Riz Ahmed. Like this is it's a very small movie, but just the way that movies landed in people's laps this year, I would fully expect it to be one of those kind of movies that like if it was released in theaters, it would be like one of many, but with a more narrow focus, he could totally win an Oscar off of this performance and legitimately earn it. Like it is an incredible, incredible performance of someone just like whose life dramatically changes almost overnight. And just like the sheer panic on his face is that kind of sustains throughout the movie really blew me away. Sound of Metal. Anybody else seen this?
Yeah, I saw it. I think I've seen a lot of people really praise it, which like I understand. I wasn't as blown away on my first watch of it. I thought it's good, especially for the reasons you highlighted, which like Riz Ahmed is a really good actor, and I do hope this kind of gives him some bigger roles, probably, especially like as a movie star versus TV. But also like what I found interesting from it was the deaf community aspects that they show. Everything beyond that I thought was a little conventional, especially like the girlfriend, and I don't really think she got enough to do. And then kind of, I don't know why I didn't connect with it as heavily as everyone else, but I do agree with you that it is the type of movie that like, it's good that in a year in which like movies became less saturated, you know, with big blockbusters or whatever, that like a movie like this gets to stand out and a performance like Riz Ahmed's gets to stand out. So like that was my big takeaway, but I think it's perfectly good and I would certainly recommend it to anyone, but it just wasn't top of my list.
Yeah, that's fair. I think it is just such a narrow character, like not narrow, but like a laser focused character study on Riz Ahmed. Like there are a lot of interesting side characters, including a guy who I had never heard before. Maybe I've seen him in something. He's like a classic that guy, most likely, who plays the counselor of a deaf community, who has like one really standout scene that that momentarily pulls the focus off of Riz Ahmed doing his thing. That guy is likely. Again, Oscars are very strange. I don't even know how they're going to work this year necessarily. I think the window has been extended past December 31st.
Mm-hmm.
But Oscar voters certainly make decisions based on box office, not all the time, but I think a lot of the time, and they're like not going to have that metric this year. So it'll be really interesting to see what they do when they don't have that like extra metric to throw in there. I think Sound of Metal is very much going to be one of the movies that benefits from it. Pierce, your next movie or whatever?
That's actually a good segue because it is kind of like a or whatever. It's a concert film, which is like not a normal thing that I would top my best of the year list with. But I thought this one in particular stood out this year, which is David Byrne's American Utopia. David Byrne from the Talking Heads, who like whatever it was, like 30 years ago at this point, or maybe more, they put out what is like probably the best concert film ever made with Stop Making Sense, which I also recommend if no one's ever seen that, like go watch that. It's incredible. But now, like 30 years later, he did this Broadway show before COVID, obviously, in which he performed a bunch of Talking Heads music and kind of recontextualized it for the world we live in now versus the world we lived in then. And I just thought it's like a really incredible, both musically, like I love the Talking Heads, but I also think like, even if you're not a Talking Heads fan, I'd recommend it. And like, again, because of the way he kind of recontextualizes that music for our time period. And it's so it's musically really remarkable to me, but also like visually, it's directed by Spike Lee. It's all set on stage, and he kind of, if you've never seen David Byrne perform, he really likes to like play with the space and the lighting and like kind of create this, I don't know how to describe it exactly, maybe like dystopian, almost kind of weird Americana like vibe to what he's doing that is truly unique. Like he's a one of a kind artist in many senses, but I'm endlessly fascinated by David Byrne. So like, I found it pretty remarkable. But I also like I'm saying, like, I think it does this very almost coincidental kind of messaging about society and connection and like longing for human connection and like feeling, I don't know, disconnected from the world around you, which like, if there's any feeling in the year 2020, it's probably that, right? But he did all this kind of before COVID.
Sure, yeah.
So it really hit when they finally turned it into a film and released it, that it was this kind of really bizarre, connect, like something that you could really connect to. And again, similar to Lover's Rock, like concerts don't exist anymore. Like house parties don't exist anymore. Like getting to listen to music in a large space with other people doesn't really exist currently. So like watching a concert film at home is in some ways the closest we can get to that, which is like another reason why I recommend it. I love the Talking Heads music and the way that he connects it to 2020 as this kind of, he actually throughout the concert will like in between songs give these speeches that I found really like resonant as just talking about like absurdist art and Dadaist art and like why in the last 4 years of our lives has that felt really, why is that type of art like now resonant with us, and how his music from the late 80s, early 90s now has like come back around. And I think it is like a true achievement of an artist getting to watch someone in a concert film like that, just getting them like to watch them do their shit. Like he's really one of the most fascinating guys to watch in that regard. So I really recommend it. And I think, whether you are a Talking Heads fan or not, it is a really great concert film and a surprise because like I said, like that's not every year I don't really watch a concert film, but this one stood out.
I think the only concert film I've ever seen, I think, unless I'm forgetting something, is Shine a Light by Martin Scorsese about the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And I could not, I had a really hard time with that movie. I don't think I could get through it. It was a lot of like Rolling Stones, what to me at least sounded like B-sides, just like not their hits. I mean, they've been touring for decades and decades, so that makes sense that they wouldn't necessarily want to play their hits. But I take it back. I've seen two concert films. I saw the Metallica one with Ting Dong like fighting demons or something as an interstitial. I thought that was a lot of fun. It's okay, so maybe I'm talking myself into concert films. Like, I think Scorsese just filmed the concert pretty much with some behind the scenes stuff. Like the spotlight might have burned Mick Jagger might have burned Mick Jagger alive, like he was an ant in a microfiber glass if he like stood in the right spot, which is like abstractly interesting, but it's like a single line in the movie. So it sounds like American Utopia and Stop Making Sense as well, which I have never seen, but probably should. Yeah.
I would recommend to anybody
stuff beyond just a band playing on a stage, which I don't feel like is enough to like really get you through a movie.
Yeah, I would say that's a good way of describing it. It's like it's more than just that. Start with Stop Making Sense, which is pretty regarded as one of the best, you know.
Yeah.
And then watch this one in, you know, as a double feature even, because like the way it also progresses, like something interesting about it, like, you know, this is something that this film in particular made me think about, was like David Byrne as like a cultural figure and an artist, like, you know, most people of his generation who are now these aging, you know, rock stars or whatever, like, I don't usually agree with their point of view on most things. But in this film, David Byrne kind of talks about like the way he's changing with the times, and he discusses things like Black Lives Matter and immigration, and he like does this cover of a Janelle Monáe song that she wrote and performed for Black Lives Matter activism this summer, I think, or something like that.
I gotta say, that sounds awful.
Well, no, but it's interesting when you hear him talk about it and contextualize it within why he makes art as an artist and what he sees in the world around him today. And like, it's, I don't know, I found it fascinating. And I think when you hear him speak about it all, it makes a lot more sense than maybe the way I described it right now.
I mean, it sounds like you're just describing like the bare facts of it. And I mean, I'm not crazy, right? Like, that does sound awful.
It could, if I didn't trust David Byrne, then I could very well say yes. If it was a pop star, it's like a normal pop star, but that's going to be really bad.
Yeah, this is a protest song written by Janelle Monáe by Ariana Grande.
You see the video, the DJ's like, this one goes out to all the families, people die of COVID. Like, it was weird.
I mean, that sounds like a tremendous degree of difficulty for the movie to climb. And I mean, if it can get over that, that would be a tremendous achievement.
I would like to watch this.
JR, your next thing?
Well, I just want to say this. The only thing that I've seen that I would be able to call like a concert film, well, I saw Beyonce's Homecoming. But this is it. Michael Jackson's This Is It. And I mean, it wasn't even technically a concert because it was, he died before the concert even started. But it was just him doing all the practicing rehearsals up before the concert. And I thought it was amazing because he talks about, you know, show him going through like, okay, the reason I want you to do this and, you know, we need to hit this note because of this and this and this. And so hearing another person doing that, you know, from what you were telling me, sounds very interesting to me. So watch it. Fuck John.
I didn't say I wasn't going to watch it. It is on my radar. It sounds difficult. I do want to watch it. Anyways, JR, your next thing.
So my next movie is Emma. I think it's a Jane Austen book, right? So it's about like freaking Elizabethan or Victorian or something women. why did I say it
like that? Yeah, I made a really big mark, man.
Elizabethan white women who are trying to get men, basically. Anya Taylor something or other.
Anya Taylor-Joy, had a Joel, big year.
The actress. Didn't really like the movie. I wanted to bring this up because I thought everybody's acting in the movie was very good.
But you didn't like the movie necessarily.
No, I didn't like the movie necessarily. Okay. I wanted to bring it up as best of, as in everybody, it's literally every single person I thought did a very good job acting in this movie. The three main people obviously did very, very well. And a lot of people actually thought the movie was really good. It's in a lot of like top 10, top 20, top fives of some people. Best movie. Not my thing. I don't think it was as good as Little Women, you know, which it could kind of be compared to. But not nearly as good as that, but I just wanted to, you know, want to make this one short. The acting was very, very good in it, and that kept me engaged all the time.
Do you go in for, like, costume drama, Merchant Ivory type stuff? I mean, I have a guess.
I'm down for anything.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. It did jump out on your list to me as like, huh, JR liked Emma.
Yeah, I'm not specifically looking for it, but I'm not going to, like, start the movie off with a bout. I do a pretty good job of going in blank slate into a lot of movies, so you know, it's not it's not something I'm going to search out. For instance, like Little Women, like I was like, I'm not gonna go watch this movie, but then once people were like, this is really fucking good, you said it was like your favorite movie of 2019, so I was like, well,
yes, it is, running away with it.
Yeah, like shit, I'll watch this movie, and it was very good, very good. Not
so many of those movies are like the same, like some kind of like doomed romance or thwarted romance or just any of that, any There's usually like four or five of them that just are very similar. Like Ammonite came out this year with Saoirse Ronan and Kate Winslet. Boring as fuck. I've seen that movie a dozen times. And I feel like Emma does. I haven't seen Emma, but from what I take away from it, it kind of just mixes up the formula a little bit, which is necessary, because how many movies can Keira Knightley really star in a year where she has to wear a corset?
I don't even think she's in Emma, man.
But... She's not. But she socks away at least one a year. Shane, Keira Knightley period drama did you put on your list in 2020s?
All of them. You can't just choose one. Mm. Okay, yeah, let's talk about documentaries.
I really loved Keira Knightley as Michael Jordan.
She really
killed it. A little offensive, but
I thought the blackface was too much.
Just like, what a year for fun to have these documentaries. The only movies can really get completed this year, and so you have The Last Dance, which I mean, that was it. That's all we had in media for 8 weeks, right?
Yeah. I caught up with that late.
Yeah,
like a couple months ago, and yeah, people were right to talk about it.
Did you? I mean, I assume everyone else here like this or no?
Oh yeah.
Here's what I will say. Slight disappointment on my part. Thought it was very, 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 very good. Only disappointment is it was pitched as talking about the last season. So I thought it was going to be a crazy in-depth on the last season only. So I was a little bit disappointed by that. You know, once I realized that it wasn't going to be, I very, very easily got over that disappointment. I was like,
that's a good point. Like, they did really sell in the first episode, I think, of how behind the scenes in-depth footage, or how much behind the scenes never before seen type stuff they got. And I didn't feel like there was anything so incredibly mind blowing or anything, right?
Just the fact that you had Michael Jordan talking. Sure. I mean, which is. You know, they could talk. We talk about. I know the Taylor Swift one here too. That's both of these are documentaries that the people who they're about are involved, which makes it weird. But I feel like The Last Dance, because I don't know, they got Jordan drinking whiskey. He opened up. It was interesting. I know he controls the narrative still, but it's just.
Does he? Did he in the Last Dance? Like, I don't know that.
Yeah, he.
Not knowing anything about the Taylor Swift documentary Miss Americana. I have strong suspicions that she had like final say over everything that got into the movie.
Oh yeah,
I didn't get a sense of that from The Last Dance.
I think Jordan did have final cut.
Did he?
Okay. Yeah, he did, and it's probably why there's no family stuff in here, and he had that call. But
that is an odd thing to leave out. Like, it's thematically appropriate for something that is a documentary, but yeah, where is his family? Like, they don't do. His sons give talking heads in the last episode? Is that right?
I think so. I think that's right.
Okay, but I feel like it's brief.
Yeah, so...
I mean, they had to have at least said something throughout this. Like, I mean, yeah, I'll say that was weird. Interview them, ask them, what's it like with your dad being... You know, you're six, and your dad's the best basketball player on the planet.
I would watch that documentary. Like, give me that one. That'd be great. Yeah, Last Dance. I mean, there's a couple of like ESPN ones came out. The Bruce Lee one was good. The Cubs, Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire one was the worst document I've ever seen.
But did they have present day Sammy Sosa in there?
Yeah, and that's why it sucked. It sucked so bad. Okay. It was mostly about Mark McGwire.
Anyway, he looks like a monster.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was bad. Don't watch. So, yeah, good year for some docs. Look some up.
I think the crew in Atlanta described Sammy Sosa as a white penis.
Yeah, that's right? What I was thinking of.
Okay, they're not wrong. My next thing is a game that came out in, I want to say, 2013, but some part of my year was filled with video games, because you know, your options are limited, and one of those video games released a sequel in 2020. I didn't play that one. I played the second one, which came out in 2013. I really just want to talk about this because it provided me with like my favorite gaming moment of the year, and I want to use this captive audience to just brag on myself. So, Crusader Kings 2 is a grand strategy game. There's an incredible amount of detail. It goes from like the year 870 to 1415, and you're using more or less the exact same tools that the real lords and ladies of that period of time would have used to like consolidate power and expand their territory. And you only have so much control. Like there's all kinds of like random events within the world, and you're constrained by like feudal laws. So stay with me. It's very easy for like your preferred people to not become your next leader. And my crowning achievement in this game was I was the king of Croatia, and I had four sons, and my best son was the third born. So I had to figure out a way to make him inherit everything and isolate his brothers, because if I died and my third son was king, they would be extremely upset and make life hell for the preferred heir. So I was able to inherit the third guy, and I proceeded to exile the youngest son to the Knights Templar, kill the second brother, and go to war with the first brother, and win just barely thanks to an alliance with the Kingdom of Arles, wherever it's like modern Switzerland and Northern Italy, and imprison him and exile him. Huge win. So proud of myself. I felt like I was reenacting history. Truly one of my highlights in a very strange year.
So
that's a free game on Steam. Very complicated. I barely have my hands around it, but I would recommend anybody pick it up. I love those kind of real-time strategy games.
Yeah, this sounds like the next game I'm going to play. I don't play a lot of video games, but when I do, I play RTSs, and this sounds amazing.
If there was an instruction booklet with it, it's probably like 100 pages long. It is, like I said, I barely understand what's happening.
It's basically got it's like the same level of crap as like a full board of Command and Conquer.
Much more complicated than that. It's not about fighting as much as it is about like intrigue and subterfuge and favor. Like making sure all your lords like you and all your bishops like you. And the initial game is free, and then there's like $400 worth of patches that have come out over the years. And again, like the third one just came out this year. So that is actually new, but I played the free one. And again, I was able to murder my family and assume power. It was just fucking great. So proud of myself.
So when you were talking, I imagined like Skyrim or a game like that. And then I Googled this while you were talking, and this is like Age of Empires.
It's a 1,000-yard view of Europe and
right.
And North Africa and the Middle East. So you don't have different units to pick from. There isn't really resources to gather beyond just cash and prestige and piety, which are like abstract. And all you're doing is just consolidating your power and expanding it.
Wow. There's I want to congratulate you on your conquering of the kingdom or whatever it was, John. I really do.
I mean, the best thing that came out of it was that I got like one tiny extra territory. The stakes are extremely small as well. Like, you're not going to conquer the world. You're going to maybe consolidate modern day Croatia in my case. Like, that would be a great scenario and not die over the course of this game.
Those are my people. I wish you wouldn't just flippantly.
Serbia?
Talk about Croatia.
Serbia annihilated. Wiped them off the fucking map.
Wow.
So proud of myself. People. But not John. The most. Myself. Yes, go ahead. I'm really
John. What was the name of your kingdom territory?
It was Croatia, but I was house. I'm gonna take a stab at a name with way too many consonants in it. Trpermovich.
House Trpermovich. You couldn't just pick your own.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, what fun is that?
Yeah. John Landia. John Slovakia.
Extremely a huge amount of fun. At the moment, I'm in a holy crusade against Ghana, and they are murdering everybody. You can't cross the desert without losing half your forces.
Just think about what John Landia's national flag would be. I think it would just be a black flag that somehow could never blow in the wind. It just hung there limply.
Everyone will forget this eventually. That'll be my motto. Pierce, your last thing?
My last pick is probably like the happiest, or like the thing that by watching it made me the happiest this year, and that's Ted Lasso, which was like really a surprise that, you know, towards the end of the year, I had my list of TV shows that I planned on binging over my holiday break. And Ted Lasso was just like the last one I wasn't really looking to watch, but I had time, so I put it on. And it is like just truly a delight. It is a funny sitcom. Like, it has actually funny humor to it. But on top of it, it's like a kind of a heartwarming sports story that like doesn't exist anymore. A lot of people have like compared it to Hoosiers, but like, it's not even that serious of a sports drama. But like, you know, the essential gist of it, it was this commercial for, I want to say like NBC Sports was doing like a cross promotion with the Premier League or something. So they had Jason Sudeikis play a college football coach who like has been signed to be the manager of a Premier League soccer team, which is like a funny fish out of water cultural thing that they then turned into, you know, a decade later, like a full blown TV show. And it just works. It is, like I said, like the kind of point of the show is that Ted Lasso, the coach, knows nothing about soccer, is kind of set up to fail, but has this incredibly positive attitude and like is a great leader and a kind like person. And it's just really refreshing to like watch him, watch this character on screen. And like over the course of the show, you begin to root for Ted Lasso in the way that like the characters in the show begin to believe in him. And it's just like, honestly, like in a cheesy way, it really is touching just to like have a positive TV show in the world, or like a positive thing to watch instead of, I don't know, sitting around just like dreading life.
Is it like safe to say that the biggest negative of this is it's only on Apple TV?
I mean, I do think if it wasn't on Apple TV, I think more people would probably have gotten into it. You know, like full transparency, like I don't have an Apple TV subscription, but I won't say how I watched this.
Criminal.
Sorry, the cops are busting through my door right now. I don't know why it's so captivating. I think it's kind of taken Twitter by storm as well. Like everybody that watches it seems to have the same reaction, which is like, I didn't expect this to be good, but now it's like touched my heart and I'm a changed person. And it really is. Like, I recommend it to everybody. I think at least like Shane and John, since we are all coaches of youth sports, like it's a pretty fitting comedy for that. But, you know, I would recommend it to anybody as a funny show when we don't really get a lot of like funny sitcoms anymore, but also just like a positive, joyful, a breath of fresh air or whatever within the world. So Ted Lasso, absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I signed up for Apple TV to watch Wolfwalkers and Boys State.
Oh yeah.
To 2020 movies. And the first thing I watched was this instead. And I blasted through it in like 2 or 3 days. It is everything Pierce says is maybe my favorite TV show of the year. Although I don't make those lists anymore. I've fallen way behind on current TV. I watched Paddington 2 3 times this year. And this, I think is very much in that tradition of the David Ehrlich coined nice core term.
Yes.
Where definitely. There is conflict in it, but it's conflict that isn't stretched out because the show needs it to. It's conflict that would naturally arise and would naturally be solved if everybody just kind of agreed on their basic humanity and on, as Paddington would say, kindness and politeness and just making the world right in that way. It is all in, and it's also funny, and it's got really good characters. And I don't watch it regularly, but soccer is fun to watch in a lot of formats, including this one. And soccer, it could have easily been like cricket or some other fish out of water sport for an American, and they would still work. Like this is Bill Lawrence, who also made Scrubs and Cougar Town, and I think something else in between. I think this is easily the best thing he's ever done. It's got that earnestness that Scrubs. I never watched Cougar Town, but Scrubs had a lot of earnestness, but without any of like the ironic edge that some characters brought to it. I couldn't think of a negative thing to say about it.
Yeah, 100%. Truthful, like a true fact right now, John. On my mantle in my house that I'm looking at right now, I have a signed picture of the entire cast of Scrubs because I love Scrubs.
Okay. Wow.
But I also, like, I understand people don't like Scrubs. Ted Lasso is better than Scrubs, and I love Scrubs. But, like, Ted Lasso is truly, it's just a delight. It's really good TV.
Jason Sudeikis is in two of my favorite SNL skits of all time. Main Justice.
Potato Chip?
And Potato Chip.
I don't know what the first one. I guess in the second. JR, your last item?
Yes, my last item is a TV show that I've talked about before, and I've told Shane he's got to watch it with his kids, but it's a cartoon called Craig of the Creek. It's exactly what it's about. Sounds about it's about three kids that are like best friends. A girl named Kelsey, Craig, the main character, and a boy named JP. And they have like three jobs in the creek. She's a warrior. JP is like the 16-year-old that's hanging out with 12-year-olds because he's so dumb. And that's his job. And Craig maps out the creek. So it's like very much... It feels like a show that some between my age and like 34 wrote this show, because they're like, I want to make a show that reminds kids of like Dexter's Lab and all these shows that I watched growing up. And even in some of the episodes, they reference, like, someone's like, you guys remind me of Ed, Edd n Eddy. Like, a guy in the episode says something like that. But, what it is they do all this stuff in the creek, and, you know, it's one or two episodes per show. I think it's one, maybe two, whatever. But it is a kid show that is good for adults to see as well. But in season three that came out in 2020, they finally went to the other side of the creek. So in their side of the creek, they have just this, like, they have like a council where they come together to solve the problems of the creek, and there's like the anime/manga kids send a representative, and Craig is the representative for his people, and there's like a group of people that are like, they play horse, and so they send the horse kids have a representative, and they've got this like whole democratic process, and, you know, they're all having fun over here in their own ways. And like, they've teased it over the course of a couple episodes, over the course of the first two seasons, there's this other side of the creek where there's a king who determines how everyone has fun and all this stuff. And so in season three, they've ventured more into this other side of the creek, and they're like doing these like tragic backstories for the king and how he didn't actually want the power, but he's got the power, and there's this protector that protects the two sides of the creek from ever interacting with each other. And he's like some lone survivor guy that his like whole existence is just sitting on this bridge between the two sides of the creek. It's in the same vein as Ted Lasso, not as like the same type of show, but you just enjoy watching it. It's fun. I watch it with my niece and nephew. I'd been watching it myself entirely because Craig and his family are black. So I was like, I'm going to watch this show just because you watch more shows with black people, you're going to start making more shows with black people. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm watching it because that I realize, like, I'm like, damn, this is actually a good show.
I was say, per your recommendation, we've watched this. Then I was upset that Jeff just crushed it so fast while I was at work one week and just knocked out all the episodes. So I didn't get to watch as much as I would like to have.
It's like my niece and nephew, they watch it. They're like, okay, it's dinner time. Let's, as a family, sit down and watch an episode or two of Craig of the Creek. And then, like, my mom, you know, the beginning of the pandemic, my family was, like, getting together a little bit. Yeah, probably shouldn't say that, but whatever. And, we were like watching Craig of the Creek, you know, everyone's laughing, my mom and dad, you know, my sister, my brother-in-law, me, the two niece and nephew, you know, they're 6 and 3 or however old they are. Everybody likes the show. So, you know, you get good shows like this that are they're like, okay, let's make a show that's good and parents are going to like. And then you end up making a show that I can enjoy just on my own. And I think they did a very good job with this cartoon.
Yeah, I think a lot of people that grew up with some of like the worse PBS shows and like the Nicktoons stuff, like your Rugrats and like and your Rocko's Modern Life. I always thought those shows were terrifying as a kid. I feel like it's probably never been better to be like a little kid watching TV just because of shows like I've never seen Craig of the Creek, but like shows like that and a lot of the other stuff the Cartoon Network is doing, like Adventure Time and Regular Show and
yeah, Steven Universe and
sure, yeah, Steven yeah. Universe and like those. I've only ever really seen Adventure Time of and Over the Garden Wall, which is also great. But like, I've been getting Jeff into Shane's larger child into Adventure Time when I watch him on Mondays, and he's a fan. And yeah, you don't have to like stomach the awful shit that I'm sure exists out there. I don't know what it would be necessarily because I'm not seeking these shows out necessarily.
Cartoons.
Like, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure. Just like all TV,
new season
just
of
more of
new season everything. Of Hello Ninja dropped, so we watched that tonight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. You sound pretty thrilled about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you say Hello Ninja?
Yeah.
I feel like that's the last thing you
my
would say.
Favorite,
to ninja,
the, like my favorite animal in the world is a ninja, and they ruined it.
Yeah. Shane, your last thing?
I'll just keep talking about it. I was going to say HBO Max in general is amazing. It's fantastic. There's so much.
How many months did you pay for it before actually getting to access it?
Probably 6 months. So, but my God.
And I thank you.
It's better. It's just so much better than Netflix. The options for kids, I think, are better. I didn't know that there's this whole Looney Tunes thing where they came out with like these new. They came out with two new seasons at one point in like 2010, 2013. Mm-hmm. Like Kristen Wiig was involved. Fred Armisen.
I love that show. I'm sorry.
Yes, it is.
I
so
fucking good. Love that. I watched that week to week while it was coming out. I love that shit.
It's like Muppets plus the original Looney Tunes slapstick. It's just got this great dry sense of humor. Like I laugh out loud multiple times per episode where the kids are not laughing.
Yeah. So, it's called The Looney Tunes Show, and they're like living in a cul-de-sac. Is this are we talking about the same one? Yes.
Yep. Yep.
Great fucking show.
And they have storylines that go on through multiple seasons. It's good.
Yeah. HBO Max is probably my favorite streaming service. They're really the only ones that have anything before, I don't know, 1990. And what they have before 1990 is like extensive. Like they have like the Turner Classic Movies library. So you've got a lot of Criterion stuff on there. You've got a really great doc selection. They've got all the Miyazaki movies, all the Studio Ghibli movies. They've got Cartoon Network stuff, like Adult Swim stuff.
Yeah, you're watching all that shit. I'm watching Tim and Eric. That's how I'm plowing through that. It's just what a brilliant show.
I assume Steve Brule is on there too.
I'll work out.
Might be different licensing there. That would be a true tragedy.
Yeah.
One without the other. I worry about HBO for a lot of reasons. Like AT&T is a terrible corporate overlord, and I feel like they're pushing HBO, which had like a really strong quality control mechanism, to just be Netflix and crank out stuff that is long because it can be. And there's so much true crime bullshit. I can't get into any of that stuff. HBO might be the worst perpetrator of it.
If they can do that and continue to make good shows,
I feel like they've already passed the point of no return. Like, isn't like the Heaven's Gate one? Is that on HBO?
I don't know.
I feel like there's a new one every week between one streaming service or another. And HBO is like, well, I feel like they were airing one in the HBO fashion, like one a week.
Yeah, the Heaven's Gate one was
at the start of the year, and then they did the Nexium thing, and I'm sure there were others in there the Serial Trial of Adnan Syed, that might have been last year, but I don't know. It's a long list. That kind of stuff just seems totally devoid of any inspiration.
I've retired from true crime too.
Good for you. I don't see the appeal. And then also what they're going to do this year with like the releasing of movies on HBO Max and theaters just makes me really nervous. I feel like theater chains haven't gone bankrupt yet. I feel like it's one major one has got
to
happen.
I'm not really looking forward to that either. I don't know. I mean, I'm glad I didn't pay to see Wonder Woman, though. I do know that.
So am I.
I paid.
So am I.
I paid.
You said.
I paid. Not only did I paid true IMAX prices. So it was like $20 for me to go see this movie after all the fees and shit. And man, was it fucking bad.
Yeah, you would have been right to ask for a refund.
Can I shout out some other some HBO Max gems that I'd recommend?
Yes.
Yes.
Talking about cartoons, actually, both of them are cartoons. There's one Adult Swim cartoon that I had never heard of till this year that is now up on HBO Max, or at least one season of it, called Primal, which is like
Gindy Tarkovsky.
It's the guy who did like Samurai Jack and a bunch of other Cartoon Network stuff from when I was a kid, at least I know. But it's violent, so it's not for like children. But it is a very, again, like heartwarming kind of silent cartoon about a caveman befriending a dinosaur. And they just kind of like survive in the like prehistoric era, like fighting other dinosaurs and shit. And it's both very cool, but also like very well done and sweet. And I recommend that to anybody. And then the other one is the Harley Quinn cartoon, which is like one of those things that existed kind of in like a no man's land of streaming until HBO Max came along. And it is like an adult comedy cartoon centered on like Harley Quinn that is actually funny rather than the like DC movie about her that I didn't find very interesting. But like,
the
cartoon show is like actually for adults and very, very funny. So I recommend both of those.
That'll do us for our best of 2020 recap. Check us out on the MediaCommovie.club, where you can find reviews of our current movie trio, The Last King This is not that movie is not about Idi Amin. The King of Long for fuck's sake, The King of Staten Island, which is available on HBO Max. And Soul, which is available on Disney Plus, and Gangs of New York, which I believe is on Netflix. While you're there, you can check out our past reviews of our previous movie trios, as well as many, many, many reviews of 2020 movies and others on our Side Pieces tab, primarily written by myself. Like us on Facebook at Munich Movie Club. Follow us on Twitter at Munich Movie Club. Instagram, Munich Movie Club. I'm John_Kissel at Letterboxd, and Pierce, you are?
PB Movies at Letterboxd.
Is that new? Did you change your name?
No, I think I was plugging the wrong name for many months. Okay. Well, my Twitter name is different, but my Letterboxd name is something else.
Well, those followers are just going to blow up getting the name right.
That's fantastic.
thank you for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Peace. Good night.